In this episode of the Big Picture Skiing Podcast, I speak with former Olympian, bronze medalist in World Championships, innovator, Eric Schlope. Now, I've spoken to Eric before in the past, but it was sort of an impromptu chat where I just put my phone on the table, hit record, and the sound was not great. Although the information and the knowledge shared was top shelf, so inspiring. And so I wanted to get Eric back on the Big Picture Skiing Podcast to share some of the same sort of insights he gave there, but more. And as I've evolved with this podcast and learned to ask better questions, I think I'm getting more out of my guests, and this one is no exception. So I feel always inspired after chatting to people like Eric. My goal is for you to feel the same. So what are you going to get inspired about? Well, let me tell you, Eric is going to share some insights around ski boot setup, footbeds, boot board, the side of the shell, what he's looking for in modifying that boot so he can perform with his feet and make a great turn. You're going to hear if he thinks that there was certain advantages he had or great skiers have that make them better than other people, whether that's psychological, physical, technical, that sort of stuff. So you hear his thoughts on that. We discuss his son, you know, things he's learnt because he's quite a lot taller than Eric. So learning to see things through the eyes of someone with a different type of body and how he's helping to share that when he's coaching other people. I also asked him what he would say to the general public and a lot of skiers out there in terms of what he's seeing them do on the mountain. I think that's a really interesting and fun part. So he's got some recommendations probably for you right there on what you should do for your skiing. Some of his favorite drills he likes to use to help himself and others really get the feel for a good turn. So there's lots in this episode. Well, thanks Eric for being on the show, and thanks to you for listening, watching, and being a supporter of the Big Picture Skiing Podcast. Really appreciate it. It's starting to get cold here in Australia, so I can't wait to get on snow. But in the meantime, those in the north, those waiting for it, hopefully this is something to fill in that time and keep your skiing mind frothing and looking forward to the next time you get on snow.
Do you think that there is something that you have as an advantage over other skiers? So people that get to the top of the game, maybe it's psychological, maybe it's strength.
That's a really good question, and one that there, I don't know if anybody's ever been able to break it down. You know, I think there's certain levels that top World Cup skiers have physically. Let's just start with the easiest one. You have to be very strong. If you're not super strong, doesn't matter how, you know, how good your touch is on the snow or how strong you are mentally. If you can't hold 800 pounds on one leg 60 times in a row and just, you know, hammer anaerobically, you're not gonna make the World Cup. But to be honest, that's the easiest thing. It's so tangible. You can get in the weight room. You know, I think there is a certain genetic component that allows people to get to a certain strength level faster. And it might, you know, it might be impossible for some. It's certainly the easiest one to address. There's nobody on the World Cup that started skiing, not ski racing, but skiing after age 4. So I put skiing in a category with golf, surfing, even gymnastics. Is such a technical sport, and there's so many little nuances to the sport and so many variables, and you can make it so complicated that if you learn the sport and you can't remember learning the sport like a language, then that's sort of the key to the foundation of success. I don't remember learning English, and I don't remember learning how to ski. Anything I remember learning, I'm not great at. I can be good at it, but I'm not great, and certainly not world class. So, you know, you've got that as well, the touch and feel on the snow, balance, understanding the fall line. And then as you progress through the ranks and as you get older and into, let's call it World Cup age, sort of 20, 22 to, you know, the end of your career. I was 37 when I retired. That's when all the details matter. That's when all the little things matter. You know, I know there was a study on, and unfortunately, I don't know all the details, but on British cycling team. So they were trying to make 1% difference in 100 different categories. And I can really relate to that, because 1% in 100 different categories totally changes things. It changes the big picture. And, you know, it's like laying a sheet of paper on a table. You can't see where the sheet and the table separate. It just looks like it's all one. But then you start to stack them up and you get 100 sheets of paper and it's way off the table. So every little detail is like a sheet of paper and you lay it on top of each other. And before you know it, it's a material difference. I think that's what separates the great athletes, is that they pay attention to every sheet of paper.
So then back to the born basically on skis part, or skiing from a young age, do you remember your coaches or do you remember your friends having a certain, like, were you always mucking around on jumps? Were you always trying to just go as fast as you can in a straight line? Anything like that?
100%. I remember ever since I was little, skiing was, it was in my blood. It was part of the, it was part of our family. My parents were ski instructors. My sister was a skier. Actually, she was a great skier. She was NCAA giant slalom champion. And so we were lucky. We grew up in Buffalo, New York, just outside of Buffalo. And my mountain until I was 12 wasn't a mountain. It was a hill. It was 400 vertical feet. So just over 100 meters. It's nothing.
Yeah.
However, when you're 4 years old, you get very comfortable very quickly on a hill, as opposed to like a super ski resort like Park City. You know, you go skiing at Park City, it's a wonderful experience. But when you're 4 years old, you can get lost fast. There's a lot of people, it's crowded, there's chairlifts, there's miles, 4,000 skiable acres. I just would go up and I knew where the hot chocolate was and the marshmallows, and I'd go ski. And I would look for every jump. And actually, one of the stories that my parents love to tell is one of my first races, it was a slalom, and I'm coming down. And slaloms there with that short a hill are 20 seconds, even when you're 5 years old. So I'm coming down the slalom hill, and I knew there was a jump off to the side because I helped build it. So right in the middle of a slalom tournament, I just arced right outside the course, hit the jump, nice spread eagle, and then I came back in for the last couple gates, and I was like, wait, how come I didn't get a time? So I was all about skiing, not just racing, but hitting jumps, going fast, going through the trees. I mean, even silly stuff. I mean, in the 70s, ballet was still a thing. So I would enter freestyle competitions and do ski ballet. So, you know, just anything on skis, and just to become a better athlete with boots and skis on.
Do you remember then, on the 1% things, do you remember when you started going, you know what, these boots are rubbish, I need some better boots, or these skis are too soft?
Oh, man. So when a fellow Olympian, Dane Spencer, who we'll talk about later, but he always complains about me because I never complain about equipment. And I honestly think that I should have more. I was an innovator, so I came up with double stacking, or, you know, I was always doing stuff with my equipment, but I never dialed in the small details because I couldn't feel the difference. I would just make it work. So my teammates also would make fun of me. They would say, you're all touch, no feel. So that meant I had really good touch on the snow, but I couldn't feel the difference if my cants were off or if my bevel was off. And I've gotten better at that, honestly, since I've retired. And I look back and I'm like, man, that would have made a huge difference if I could have zeroed in on small things like that. Still being innovative, but really taking care of the perfect bevel, the perfect canting, the perfect boot setup. But I was lucky enough where I could get on anything and make it work. So kind of ultimately, it was a disadvantage because I wasn't sensitive. I just, I'm like, oh yeah, I can make this work. These feel good. So, it's kind of funny. It was kind of a there was like a catch
Yeah,
22 there.
double-edged sword, you know,
Yeah.
like
Like Dane gets
yeah.
mad 'cause he's like, "Oh, it doesn't matter what you ski on, you can go fast and make it work." But then I'm like, "Well, yeah, but had I been a little more sensitive, it would have forced me to pay a little more attention to
You might have been consistently
yeah.
fast, the
Right.
fastest.
Yeah,
Yeah,
could have made a huge
interesting.
difference. And at the
Yeah.
World Cup level equipment, if you don't have the right setup, it doesn't matter if you're the best skier in the world, you're not gonna be dominating.
Double stacking.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was watching a video, a classic history one, because I was just, you know, always doing a bit of research. Your name
Yeah.
in YouTube. And
Yeah.
the someone, yeah, was talking about some accolades, and they're like the first person to double stack. So can you, that was sort of a new, I think I have a bit of an idea, but explain it. How did you come up with it? Why?
Yeah. Okay, so I was 19 years old. At that time it was 1992. The end of 92 winter. So I was going to turn 20 in August. So we were still on 210 giant slalom skis. And I was on Dynastar skis and they were good. But I noticed when I'd get it way tipped up and I would start to pressure it, that I would boot out. So I'd tip the ski up and the snow was hitting the bottom of or the inside of my boot, sort of by the navicular, and pushing the boot back off the snow. So I was losing pressure. And so I thought to myself, I was like, well, what about just going up? And then I can go over more and have more leverage. And it'll take my boot further off the snow so I can get a higher edge angle and the snow won't get in the way. Because we were grinding our boots, but I mean, that was like you get a millimeter out of that. So
Yeah.
I threw on, at the time, we were on a plate called Derby Flex, one of the greatest innovations of ski racing in the history of our sport. It was a metal plate, might have been aluminum with rubber, and then you would screw the front and the back. And it was really one of the first lifters and dampeners out there. And so we were all using Derby Flex. It was like sort of this new innovation. Been using them for maybe a year or two. And then in slalom, we were using just plastic lifters that were probably 5 centimeters high. I mean, they were high. Maybe no,
Yeah.
maybe, probably 3 or 4 centimeters. Five's pretty high. 3 or 4 centimeters, but high. So I took my slalom, I got an extra set of the slalom lifters, which are just plastic, super light, and I mounted those on top of the Derby Flex. And I was having an okay year, but this was in February. I tested it and I was like, oh, game on. So I go to Europe. Every single race I entered from that point to the end of the season, I won first place. So Europe fist races, come back, I win back to back Super G giant slalom US Nationals at age 19, then go to NORAMs and I win GS and Super G. And
This is
they,
beating some big names at the time, yeah.
oh yeah, I mean, in Super G we had AJ Kitt and Kyle Rasmussen and giant slalom, there were guys that were a couple years older than me at the time that were on the World Cup, and then the NORAMs had a good field, and so that double stacking really worked for me. And even though everybody caught on and started doing it, I don't know if it was because I was the first to do it or because it just suited me, and the extra leverage really worked for me. It kind of kept me
That
ahead
little bit
of the
ahead.
competition. Whereas, maybe I was here, then I went here. But then everybody went up, but I didn't fall back to here. It just worked for me. So,
So
yeah.
no one had really done that before,
No,
and then
it had
did the
never
FIS
been
have to
done.
put rules in?
Apparently, I'm sorry.
Did FIS go, hang on, no, we're not allowed to allow us this much height?
Yeah. So, I mean, some would say I'm responsible for the max height rule. Yeah,
Okay.
because at the time, I mean, I was probably now the max height is, I think, 50 millimeters. I was probably 65, 70 millimeters off the snow.
Wow.
So it was like this thick. And, I mean, you could really lay it over. But with 210s, I mean, it was like the more the better. And, I don't
And
know
that
when.
feeling, I've never been that high, but do you just feel like way more grip and power as well? Like, as not just booting out, do you feel like,
Oh yeah, no, grip and power goes way up.
okay.
And the cool part of this story too is, my roommate and housemate in Europe and like a brother to me is Bodie Miller. And he's 5 years younger than I am. But he tells the story of, so at the time he was 14 and he caught wind of the double stacking, and he told his coaches, "Oh, I want to double stack." And they're like, "You don't need to double stack." And so he just went and did it himself. And this is when he was 14. I didn't even know who he was. We didn't meet till several years later. And it's kind of fun to know that he wanted to double stack, and it was something I came up with. And he's very innovative himself. And part of the reason why we get along so well is because we're both different and sort of unapologetically different. It's like, hey, I'm this is the way I'm doing it, and I don't care what you think of me. Like when I play golf, I one arm chip, and everyone gives me a hard time. But I'm like, hey, that's what works for me. I don't care. Do what you want.
Yeah.
But when I golf with Bodie, he's like, yeah, go for it. You should one arm chip. It works for you. So it's like, we're both very open minded and also not afraid to be different. And
That's
that's
probably an
where we gel.
advantage,
Yeah.
isn't it? Back to that
Well.
first question, I think in some ways
Yeah.
that is because you go and explore things that, what if Bodhi went, oh, my coach said no, and so we
Right.
just didn't do it. And what if
Exactly.
you're like, oh, no one else is doing this, so I'd better not do it. But you just
Yep.
like stuff it.
Well, and here, so kind of dovetailing a little bit here. My son ski races. He's first year FIS, just finished his first year FIS. And, if his coaches say something or somebody tells him, oh, that's how the Norwegians do it or that's how the Austrians do it, my response is, hey, that's great if you want to be second place. If you're going to copy someone else, you're always going to be second place. You have to innovate and create a way so other people say that's the way Eric Schlope does it. So that means you've created something that other people want to emulate. But if you're going to emulate, you can never be as good as the original. So you're always going to be just behind. So that's my concept is like, hey, if you want to like just be right behind somebody, then yeah, do exactly what they're doing. If you want to beat them, find something that's better.
Okay. Now, part of the reason I wanted to chat again is because the original conversation we had at George's house, I had my phone on the table, hit record, like this little dodgy thing, and the sound wasn't great. So I wanted a chance to do it, have a redo here. But say now we're talking about innovating and boots and playing around with stuff. You went through and you laid out to me, even starting at the level of the binding, then the boot board, the footbed, the shell. What do you think? I found the boot board part really interesting. So can you start there, what you played around with your boot board?
Yeah, it's funny. Coincidentally, last week I did a I don't know, it was a podcast, but it was a live Q&A with Harold Harb. So it's I think it's Harb Ski Systems. And Harold and I go way back, and he's with an Aussie, Peter Stone. So they work together. So I hopped on there and we talked about stuff. And Harold Harb, kind of similar, he sort of innovates his own stuff. He comes from a very scientific background and approach. And I met him probably when I was in my late 20s, 27 maybe, and really appreciated how deep he would dive into boots. And I have a very rigid foot. So this is my right foot. My arch is very high and is very rigid. And if you look at Bodie's foot, he's got a very flat foot and he's got double joints. So he's got wide ankles, flat foot, and he can really line up his ankle, his foot, ankle, tibia, fib, tib fib, knee, hip, everything to sort of stack his skeletally stack myself for like really good strength. And with a high arch and a stiff foot, it's kind of like a sprinter's foot, really. And so it's good for just straight ahead, but as soon as I want to do this, there's so much pressure. And it's the equivalent of, and we may have talked about it last time, it's like a light switch. It's either on or off. And in skiing, you know, for me, I wanted a dimmer switch. I wanted to be able to sort of start here and then like crank it up as I'm turning. And so one of the solutions that, you know, or one of the ideas we had, and Harold helped me, was we routed out the medial side of the boot board. So if this is my foot, this is on from here to the outside is the lateral side, medial side is this side.
Big
So
toe side.
yeah, big toe side. So right down the center, we went 2 millimeters down and then we put foam in. So all of a sudden I could just sort of push down into it. Now I've thought since and recently, be interesting to try the lateral side for
Oh,
different
yeah.
reasons. Yeah, for different reasons because it's that inside edge engagement. So,
True. Yeah, that's th when that grabs hard like a light switch, that sucks, doesn't it?
yeah,
Yeah.
totally.
Yeah,
Totally.
that's interesting.
So, like thinking about it, I'm like, you know what? Actually, I wish that I had tried the opposite. I mean, it was nice on the medial side, but I'm like, I wonder if the lateral side would have actually been better because, like, if you're turning this way and it's on the lateral side, then you get a little cushion and for almost a better, smoother inside edge.
On that too, I just like my thoughts too. Wouldn't it be interesting if you also from like front to back changed it?
Right.
Right? You
Yes.
know, like so
Yep.
when you, because you know, you can be on the front, but when you really drive, the heel hits down. So yeah, that'd be pretty cool to play with both those ends of like the dimmer switch.
Yeah, and I like your thought because what I'm starting to learn is actually from the binding to the tail, having a lot of power there is a good thing. Less power up front. And
Yes.
so as you lay it over, so you don't get that sort of like jacked over
Exactly.
your tips feeling where you can keep pressing. And then once you get to the front of your binding, that's when the power comes in. And then you can really push because you're not going to get jacked over your tips at that point.
Sorry to maybe change paths here, but one thing I've found is like so many people are like, seem to emphasize like you've got to get the tip biting and you know working, like if you bend the tip like early, like that's great, but when I make a good turn, that when that happens, I feel like I can't progressively get into the turn. I don't want that to happen at that moment, right? That top part is all set up,
Yeah.
so is that
So,
kind of what you're almost talking to there?
yeah. So think about the tip of the ski. Like, think about how flexible the tip is. Like, if you flex just the tip, it's like wow, 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 and then it's thick under your foot. And so if you go too hard into the tip, that's going to create a lot of friction. So,
Yeah.
meaning that it's
Slow.
going to bite. And I mean, skiing's all about friction.
Yeah.
So, the less friction you have, the faster you go. So, it's like hitting the brakes in a car when you push too hard. A lot of people overpower their skis and think that's good. It's actually, you want the least amount of power to make the radius you want. Now, a lot of times, it takes a lot of power to make the radius we need, especially, you know, in racing. So you really got to be resisting a lot of forces. But if there's anything abrupt in skiing where there's too much force in too short a period of time, you are decelerating. Not to mention getting out of balance
Getting out of
because
it, right.
you don't have that smooth transition in. And honestly, yeah. Like, I want to be up and over it. I want my sternum to come up over my pelvis, and I want to be like laying into the tip, but only for a fraction of a second. It literally just bites, and then it's like you almost move back, just like just a tiny bit as the skis go out. And then, I mean, within like a couple feet, you're already moved that far down your ski, the
Yeah.
pressure from the tip to, let's call it like this far in front of the binding. And then it goes through the ski in a matter of tenths of a second from tip to tail. So you're only pressuring, and you barely need any force to get your ski tip to bend. Once your ski is bent and it's tipped up, it will pull radius. You're not relying on the tip anymore. Your
Yeah.
ski is bent like a bow, and it has side cut
Yeah.
from, this far behind the tip all the way to the tail. There's side cut. So if you have pressure on the ski and with the side cut, you only need the shovel of your ski for maybe for 30 centimeters
Yeah.
going 60. So it happens
Yeah.
fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, are you allowed to discuss an experiment you're doing? I don't know much. I don't know much. I don't know anything about it. I just, George is like, Eric and I got this like kind of crazy experiment. So,
Oh, yeah, probably not.
okay.
Probably
Okay.
not, because I'm not the only one doing it. So,
Okay.
yeah.
Okay. Cool. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then let's move on to the footbed. And maybe this, yeah, there, and then this, and then the side of the shell. 'Cause when I chatted to you, I was sort of also playing around with that part, and then you discussed Bodhi, what he was doing. So, do you want to talk to why you started? Yeah, maybe the footbed, and then the why you did the side of the shell
Yeah.
changes.
So footbed, I think we talked about this. I would prefer, and this goes for Bodie too, and Dane, and several other World Cup guys. I would prefer to have zero footbed in my boot over a posted custom footbed. Back to that whole light on off switch, a posted footbed, it's just too much. You want your foot to, well, personally, and a lot of the top guys, want their foot to articulate in the boot, as opposed to be posted. Like, let's say that again, this is your footbed. At this, if
Yeah.
this is, and it's posted under here, it's like this. It's like you're either on or off, and it's just too much pressure. So I want my foot to actually relax and articulate through the turn. And I think about my toes coming up like this, so I can't
Yeah.
make my hand do it, but
Yeah.
so like that, let's see if I can do it like that,
Yeah,
so I want my
toes up.
toes to kind of go like this in my boot, like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the other thing, so either I'd go with just the stock footbed, which is nothing, it's like a piece of cardboard, or I'd get a custom footbed with absolutely no material under it, and then I would actually cut the end off the footbed, so it was like, if this is my foot, well, let's see, if these are my toes here, the
Yeah.
footbed would only go to here, so then my toes in the boot could do this.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I could basically wiggle and pull my toes up, and then I just had like just a little support, but that footbed could actually roll inside my boot.
And then so that then brings us onto the side of the boot, because you wanted those joints in your foot, you just wanted access to them. You didn't want to post up and then just have an ankle, a knee, and a hip. You wanted that articulation. So then, because the foot can roll, you can get closer to the side of the boot. You started also being really meticulous about how the side of your foot fit against the medial side of the boot.
Well, so meticulous as in I wanted room in the navicular part of my foot. So sort of the ankle bone, your inside ankle bone, and the navicular, which is just front of that, I wanted space to be able to turn that over. Now, I can't take credit for that. That was a Bodhi, and I think Dane got, and then we talked about it, and I tried it. I'm like, this is awesome. I love it.
Pause there for a moment. Can you what so you tried it first and you're like, and what did you notice?
I noticed that a skeletal alignment in my boot. So I had more control.
Less effort.
I mean, that's a tough one because when you're going 60 and and you're making a really clean turn, it doesn't feel like anything's easier or less. It's everything. It's like more force because now I'm going faster.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say it was less effort. I would say I had just more controllable power.
Yeah, okay.
So my power was being transferred into the edge of the ski as opposed to sort of, we call it like a buck, like when your knee starts to do this.
Yeah.
So that's like pressure, no pressure, pressure, no pressure, pressure, no pressure. And you just want pressure like through the turn, like, and it's
Yeah.
like smooth and it's like you can just feel it like build and then release and it just snaps you out of the turn and as long as you keep snow contact, but you have this like massive lateral energy that you're transferring into the next turn. And it's just like there's no loss of energy. And that's.
I think that this is an area so many people that are in a more performance type boot don't realize, because they're almost like, oh no, I don't want to touch the shell, I don't want to like ruin it or whatever. And but they might not realize they're hitting straight up against with their ankle bone and their navicular. There's no pain. It doesn't have to be a pain inducing shell.
No.
That's the difference. You had no
Was not
pain.
a
You were just
fitting problem, not at all.
no.
It wasn't like, oh, my navicular hurts. I mean, it was like, oh, if I had more space to get my foot skeletally aligned with my, ankle, tibia, fibia, knee, femur, all of a sudden, that transfer of power is. And again, back to just all the little fine
The little
tuning,
things. Yeah.
and it felt better. I mean, it was more powerful, but also it kind of hurts your knee and your back when you have six,
Generating
eight
that
hundred
much
pounds of
force.
force and it's going like in and out. So
Yeah.
it felt better too.
Hey there. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Just wanted to say I'm not just a YouTuber or someone with a podcast and an obsessed skier. I have a learning platform. So bigpictureskiing.com. And an app attached to that is where I put my best material for those of you who are looking to really improve your skiing. So, intermediate to expert level, I put all the insights I've learned around technique, equipment, mindset, everything that I think, that I take on board that I go out and actually work on to make my own skiing better and how I help others is what I put right there. There's a community, really engaging community, where people can ask questions, you can leave comments that I respond to. If you're looking for a really reasonably priced way to improve and have access to a coach like myself very easily, just basically in from your pocket on your phone, check it out, bigpictureskiing.com. I hate doing these self-promotion things, but if I didn't, I'd have no business and I couldn't keep doing what I'm doing. So for those of you who already have been there, thank you very much. And those who haven't checked it out, there's a 7-day free trial, so I know it's not for everybody, but if you're struggling or you want some new ideas or consistency and be able to cover all types of skiing all over the mountain, then please go ahead, check out bigpictureskiing.com. As a listener, you can get a discount of 25% off using the code podcast. Okay, back to the show. Thanks very much.
Would you do, I don't think I even asked you, did you change much around the cuff area? Like, did you have a certain flex you liked? Did you? Yeah.
I mean, I definitely messed around some. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and it was like, the better you were, the stiffer your boots and all that stuff, which obviously changed. And Ted, was a big influence on softening boots. I do think it's very, very personal, style-wise, anatomically. Somebody like Bodie or Nyman or Bryce Bennett, tall guys, they've got so much leverage that they actually probably need to reinforce their boots beyond any of the stiffest boots ever made because they're so long. And then you add this, a lifetime of training and good genetics, and then top-notch skiing, and the forces that those long guys can create are insane. So different for me, you know. I mean, I'm strong, but I'm not 6'3", or Bryce is what, 6'8"? I mean, it's ridiculous how tall he is.
Who we are, taller, shorter, style, sort of how we hit the boot. So I guess that's a consideration. But for you then, were you looking for a sort of a certain feel, like it to really stiffen up when you hit a certain point, but be sort of able to get you there, like the ankle to flex a little bit? I know, like Ted, when I, chatted to him, I didn't realize how much he really liked to cock his ankle, like really set himself up forward and soften the boots to get there. You
No,
similar?
Ted, I mean, his most successful time of his career was after I retired, and they went to 35-meter GS skis. So they were basically going back to what we were on in 1989, to basically 210 GS skis. We had 210s with a little bit of side cut, and then now they went to like 193s with no side cut. And so I don't think it was the same. When we were on 27, 28-meter skis, they turned so much easier, and so I didn't play a ton with the flex. Man, I wish, man, I skied for almost 20 years in the World Cup, and I look back and I'm like, I really wish I had more time, because there's so many things to. So many things it could have dialed in or tried. Flex of the boot, back to sort of all touch, no feel. I was lucky I could kind of get on anything. However, I probably should have paid a little more attention to something like that.
This episode is brought to you by Carve, the digital ski coach. Now, one of the features I've had the most fun with all time is simply the fact that Carve tracks every single turn you make. I treat it a bit like Strava, so at the end of the day, it tells me exactly how many turns I've done, and those numbers keep adding up across the season. So last season in Australia, I had a few days where I was doing nearly 2,500 turns, and my legs were tired, but it was really cool to try and have that number there motivating me. And I'm quietly working my way towards my 1 millionth turn with Carve. So the other metrics I've been diving into lately, and these are new for this season, are very unique. And these are turn corridor and turn radius. And I don't see many skiers using them, but they tell you a lot about the shape and flow of your skiing. So the turn corridor shows you how far you're traveling across the hill, or the time almost between apex to apex, and how long you're taking to transition. While the turn radius measures the actual arc you create once you start the turn. So these can be different. You can have like a very wide corridor, say 18 meters, but a lower turn radius, or the other way around. So when you compare the two, it opens up a whole world of experimentation, and it would be a bit like a race coach will set different types of race courses to influence a racer or skier to change the timing and mix it up. So I encourage you to look into this if you've got Carve and play with it and see if you can manipulate it, because it's only going to improve your versatility. So I keep my Carve on my boots every single day, because you never know when like a change in technique or a new ski resort or skis will show up in the numbers. And it's great at the end of the day being able to check that, or even after the fact. And I'm really looking forward to the day I open the app and I see turn number 1 million. So if you want to explore your skiing in a completely different way, check out Carve, the digital ski coach, and thank you, team, for sponsoring this episode. Do you think, you mentioned that really great Tektika boot you skied faster in straight away, and I was trying to ask you, like, why was it better? Like, have you thought any more about that? Do you think you've nailed down, like,
Oh
why
man,
that?
I mean, so Ted also thinks that boot's amazing. Bodie, Dane, there's a like a Formula fan club, and it's the for those of us who skied on it and realized how much power was in that boot. It was basically a one piece boot, we also had the guys that made it for us. Actually, the lifter on it, besides being very high and thick, it was pre having the boot height limit was different back then. We'd go higher, so the boot lifter was super thick. It was one piece, And it was ultra high molecular density material.
Okay.
I'm probably not saying it right, but essentially, it's like crazy dense. And so I think the energy transfer back to energy transfer in the turn, the boot just it just transferred all the force you had, sometimes too much. Like I think the flaws of that boot was it was certain times too powerful, so you get in trouble. So it
Okay.
was probably
You wouldn't
like,
go take it on a powder day.
I mean, I have, but I
Okay.
wouldn't recommend it. I would not recommend it. It would be a little painful.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
So then how is your son going, Spider? How and what I'm interested to know, because being a dad myself, like has going through sort of helping him and seeing him
Yeah.
pursue racing changed or enlightened you in any way around your coaching?
I'm going to start with reinforcing my love for the sport. And it's funny, you hear the cliche is, oh, people are living vicariously through their children. I'm the opposite. I'm like, I want him to experience what I experienced. I will, so I want him to just because I had so much fun and I appreciate my time on the World Cup. I don't have to live vicariously through my son 'cause I did it and I want to share that with him. However, regardless if he does or doesn't, our journey has been so much fun and it kind of ramps up as he gets older. Just like a quick overview, he learned to ski when he was two. He skied a decent amount, but he both my kids sort of shied away from the junior programs. They wanted to ski with me, but I, my time was limited when they were little, and so we'd ski, and they were both great. And then they did part-time race programs, and then we lived in Spain for a year, didn't ski at all. And then we came back to Spider did a part-time program and then he realized, oh, I really love this. And he was 13. So he's kind of late to the game of ski racing, but he's been skiing since he was two. He doesn't remember learning how to ski. So I'm like, okay, buddy, if this is what you want to do, I'm all in to help you however I can. And knowing that I have to remind them that, hey, your peer group, a lot of these kids who are doing really well have been training and focused on racing since they were 8 or 10. You were 13, so you're behind the eight ball a little bit. You can catch up because you have all the tools. And then he grew like a weed. So I've been consulting with the tall guys. I talked to Bodie and Nyman. Hey, what's it like to be tall and a ski racer? Because I don't know what that's like.
Yeah,
And
same.
yeah, so my son is 6'3". So he's 190 centimeters tall. And he gets different leverage than I did and most people. And so it's been fun to learn as I'm watching him and trying to help him. And looking at it through a different lens, going, okay, he's going to do some this differently than I did it because he's built totally different.
I would love to know because I'm curious because coaching others and you get tall people and you can see that they're trying to figure out how to do it. Would there be one or two things you'd say that are kind of
Yeah.
key to help? So that speaking to the tall people out there.
Yeah. So, real quick, before we get to that. Spider was first year fist this year, had an amazing first couple races, and then he got mononucleosis in February. We didn't figure out until March. He'd lost 20 pounds.
Wow.
And so his season was basically only 3 weeks long. So poor guy,
And
but at the same time, mono's. Do you know what mono is?
no, I don't.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So mono is. Well, they call it the kissing disease, and essentially it gets transferred Typically with high schoolers, and the only way to transfer mono is through kissing or saliva. You could get it through somebody's spit or something like that, but typically you get it when you're in high school from kissing. And so and then what happens is it's basically your immune system shuts down and you have no energy. So you literally are lethargic for months. And there's nothing you can do. So, and it goes away. It's in your system. It's like Epstein-Barr. It's a part of it. I think Epstein-Barr is an iteration of mono. If you've heard of Epstein-Barr. Yeah.
So
So
it will
it's,
go, it's not, he's not like going to be like this forever.
oh, no. I got it. I told him, I was like, hey, you could have got, I got it Olympic year 2002. And I didn't know it, and I was having a horrible season. I'd be fast for 20 seconds, and then
Just no
slow the
energy.
rest of the time, and the whole season. And then I finally figured out I had mono, and it totally blew my season. So better to get it when you're 16 than Olympic year. So, okay. So back to Spider being 6'3" or 190 centimeters, whichever if your metric or. Or Imperial. So, one thing I learned, when he was 14, and he started out the season skiing well, and he goes to school in Vermont, so he goes away for a month or two at a time. I don't see him, so we can do things over video, stuff like that. But at the time, it was like, hey, just go be with your crew, listen to your coaches, have fun. I'll check in with you. And all of a sudden, he just sort of fell off with his performance. And I thought, what, like, why is this happening? Like, how do you go from skiing well to not well and not change anything? And then I showed up at a race in person, and he came down and the light bulb went off. I was like, oh, I needed to see this in person. I know what's happening. He outgrew his equipment. He all of a sudden his skis were too soft and his boots were too soft. And there was back to energy transfer. And I said, the analogy, or, you know, there's a lot of analogies you could do, but the one that I used for him was like, Spider, you're like an F1 car with go-kart wheels on it. Your engine has gotten bigger, but soft boots and skis are now like go-kart tires with a big engine. You're just the energy transfer isn't there. It's not returning what you need. And so you're just blowing through the equipment and there's no and the energy's just dissipating into the snow or into space. What I realized, and then he came home for a break. I put up actually, you know, I put him a pair of my boots and my old ski, like World Cup skis. And it was like instantly, two turns, he was just snapping off turns. I was like, that's it. Oh my God, I just totally learned something. Just because you're a kid doesn't mean you should be in soft boots and soft skis. It really depends on who you are. And at the time, he was 14, but he was still 6 foot tall. And he was on junior equipment that was really good for a kid who's 5'5" and 100 pounds. And he was 6 foot, you know, 150 pounds. And so, and he has that leverage. And I was like, all right, well, this all makes sense now. So I really learned that is kids don't necessarily always have to have soft boots, soft skis. Sometimes it works against them because if they're long or if they're incredibly strong at an early age, then you want that energy that you're putting into the ski to be returned back to you.
What would you say there's anything tactically, technique wise then? So there was an equipment thing.
Yeah, I mean, the other one I think is just what that I can think of right now is one that I'd say most people understand and talk about is that when you grow that much at that age, you just don't have the proprioceptive awareness of other kids who haven't grown that much, or of course adults who are used to their body. All of a sudden, your center of mass went from here to here. So all of a sudden, you don't know where you are in space anymore. So I call it it's like baby giraffe syndrome. You know, it's like, you know, these long limbs just kind of just going everywhere. And excuse me. And the center of mass, you don't know where it is. But once you grow into that, there are some major advantages, especially in every event, but in slalom, you think about in slalom, your center of mass now travel
Yeah.
can be an extra 6 inches inside the
It's
gate than anybody else or anybody like normal height. And 6 inches times 55 gates, that's 25, 30 feet. 30 feet's to a second and a half. So
yeah.
if you can harness that and you can be comfortable with getting your center mass further inside in slalom, that's a huge advantage. Now, GS might work a little bit of a disadvantage because all of a sudden the rut or the groove is close to the gate, and now you don't fit between the groove and the gate. So you get it might be a little awkward. So you have to
Interesting.
learn how to deal with that, but you still have more leverage. So, I mean,
Wow. Just that bit, because I'm definitely taking more of an interest of late what is termed like affordances. So like how you interact with the terrain. And I think a lot of the time people.
another advantage of a tall guy like a Bryce Bennett, a Steven Nyman, there's a reason why they do well in Val Gardena, because the terrain, the Chaslot in particular, has these undulations. And when you're 6'5" or 6'7", all of a sudden you've got way more shock absorber than anybody
Travel.
else because you've got travel that, oh, wow, you could stay on the ground with those long legs. And so, yeah, there's so many advantages to
But
being
yeah,
tall.
just even like in the race, the GS course, if you're training with a bunch of 5'8" dudes and you're 6'3" and they're all rutting the course, that's really gonna suck for you, right?
Yeah, because all of a sudden you get
You're
pinched. You got to learn
pinched.
how do you deal with that, you know.
Yeah.
And honestly, I have to help somebody deal with it without knowing what it feels like. So that's why I talked, you know, that's why I talked to Bodie and Nyman. These guys were tall. It's like, how did you make this work? I mean, there's probably a reason why Bodie, when he came down a GS course, half the panels got blown up because he's taller. So he wanted to be in the groove. You know, and his body just happened to, instead of hitting the gate here, he had to hit it here because he's that much taller. So, you know, there's.
So you're still involved doing quite a bit of coaching?
Yeah, I help out. Spider goes to Burke Mountain Academy. And it's been really fun for me to join the FIS men's group. Last year, I went to Mount Hood. And then I went to Belgium, I went to Europe, I went back to Burke, and I got to know all the guys. And you know, when I go work with his team, I'm not working with Spider individually. I'm working with everybody. So he's just part of the group, which is great, but I also have to look at it fairly and say, okay, I'm here with the group. It's not with my son now.
Yeah.
I might create something or go skiing with him one-on-one some other time. Of course I do that. But when I'm helping his team out, then everybody I'm helping as much as I can. And so, yeah, I helped him out. Dane Spencer was doing a return to ski program with World Cup skiers. So 2 winters ago, I skied a bunch with Nina O'Brien and Katie Hensien, a couple other ski team athletes who were coming back from injury. And that was exciting because Nina and Katie, you know, we skied a lot with them. And Dane would have me come out to do demos or have them follow me. And then to see them come out and get top five and sold in first race back was so cool. Like I really felt like I was part of that.
Yeah.
Small part, but you know, spending time on snow and giving him feedback and doing drills and talking about, you know, not just the skiing portion, but the lift ride portion, I think was very impactful. You know, because we would talk about World Cup and being an athlete and Dane and I have been there. And so for them to have two guys who've been on the World Cup for, you know, combined time over 30 years, it was a good resource for them. Plus, it was just really fun, and they're wonderful folks. You know, Nina and Katie and everybody else I skied with just really enjoyed it.
So you have a camp coming up.
Yes. So I've been talking a lot about Dane Spencer. He's same birth year as Bodie, 1977. So 5 years younger than I am, but we skied on the US ski team for a long time together. He's an Olympian as well. Amazing skier. He had some top 10 World Cups. One of the smartest people I know, also like a brother to me. So Dane and I are, we've got a small camp in New Zealand. I sent you the details. I think it's July 29th is when we land in New Zealand. We're going to do some free skiing up in Round Hill area.
Oh, I love that place.
Just focus free skiing drills, also being athleticism on skis type of stuff. And then we'll relocate down to Queenstown, Arrowtown area, get some gates going, and then a couple races, and then finish with a block of high quality gate training. Late July to, I think, August 17th are the dates. It's in New Zealand. Dane and I are the coaches, and we actually have one other guy who was on the U.S. ski team in the 90s, who's also an amazing guy and one of my closest friends. His name is Ryan Smalls. He's a ski instructor in Aspen, and his kid, Luca, ski races. So they're coming down. And should be
the
amazing.
Type of person, because I think I was asking before, it's kids, fist kids between sort of the age of like 16 and 22, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, I think there might be one a couple U16 kids going as well. So maybe 1 year before fists, and then probably up to, I don't know, mid 20s, maybe. I mean, if somebody was 30 and they loved and they're ski racing and they wanted to join us, absolutely. There's no age requirement. I would say, you know, it's nice to have a mixture, men and women, ages, you know, also different skill levels, because it's nice to have that. It's because then you have camaraderie. If everybody is super good or everybody's just are struggling, then it becomes like almost like this competition. Whereas if you have people who are just, you know, they're struggling or not super fast, but they want to be. And then you've got the fast kids. The fast kids will help the kids who aren't as fast. And then it becomes more.
And they kind of like look up to the fast ones. So the fast ones get confidence. And
the fast ones can help coach the ones who aren't as fast. So it's good for them, because when you coach, you actually learn. It's good for your ski racing. So anyway, we've got a couple slots open, and I sent you a PDF with the info.
I'll put a link in the description there so people can check that out.
Yeah, I think we've got five slots left. We'd love to.
And are you still on the, you love your drills? You still pull like.
Yes.
Kind of changed it all since last time. I think last time it was like one ski, sort of like, I can't remember what you called, edgy wedgy sort of turns, like feeling like a sort of a skid to an edge setty sort of feel.
Yeah, edgy wedgy. And then actually Dane kind of opened me up to a version of an edgy wedgy called a power wedge. It's hard to explain it.
What's the intention behind it?
Power wedge is, it's kind of an extension drill and also a line drill. Let's see if I can, I'll try. So an edgy wedgy, you basically get your angulation and pressure at the top of the turn, and you just go from edge to edge like this. Power wedge, you actually get, you keep the inside ski flat. So instead of like going like this, a power wedge, you keep the inside ski flat, and it comes across the hill like this. And as you're coming across the fall line, then you tip it up, and then actually it stays flat. Same thing, kind of stays flat. So edgy wedgy, Like this power wedge is like is I
Do you
can't
feel
it's
it? Do you get people to do like a lot? Is it more power wedge longer kind of turn rate, like, or you hold it
yes.
for longer? Would be
Yes.
yeah, so slightly
Definitely
different
more
rhythm.
across the hill,
Yeah.
more time to feel that extension and projection, but it's also good. Power wedge is great. Again, Dane introduced this to me. Power wedge is great in the course. So, like before you start training, you get in the course because it actually makes it really kind of shows you where the line is, the ideal line, because you have to come across the fall line and you have to pressure, and instead of pinching, you've got to give yourself space, and then you can pressure and come across. And your ski's flat, so the tail of your ski kind of just clips the gate or just
Yeah.
barely misses it. That's what you want. So you want to feel that line, and an edgy
That's a
wedgy,
great, yeah, that's
yeah.
a great, like, if someone's not getting it, they're not going to be able to not get it with that drill through the course, right?
Yes,
Like,
you're
hey,
forced
that.
to give yourself a little room, a little space. So many different vocabulary or words that resonate with different people. So, but I think you know understand what I'm saying is you
I
have a little
yes.
space, a little room at the top of the turn, and then you can pressure, and you yeah, if you pinch it, then you're just gonna hit the ski like in the gate like this.
Yes.
So,
Yeah, cool.
one ski drill is just timeless classic because you got to be balanced. You
Yeah.
gotta be quiet upper body. You can't be sitting back. You can't be leaning in. Like you have to be balanced, you have to be active, and you have to also be quiet with your upper body. Otherwise, it all
You can't do
goes
it.
to hell. So yeah,
Yeah.
you gotta so I love one ski. Yeah, the
Okay, here's
power
maybe this
wedge,
will
yeah.
help with the other. So maybe not just, maybe you could speak to like the races, the ones that, you know, in the middle of the pack or, you know, bottom, and maybe the general public, like at Parksea and Deer Valley, who just love their carving. Common problem. What do you reckon you see? What if you're like, you had to haul 200 of them and you're like, everybody, I don't know why you're doing this, but what you're thinking here or what you're doing there is it's not the right thing. Maybe try this or anything there.
Yeah, well, not anything. There's too many things. So
Okay.
I actually don't watch it on purpose. I mean, of course I'm on the lift and I cheer people on. I'm like, yeah, sweet. Like going for it. Like trying to make a good turn as opposed to straight lining. Straight lining just drives me crazy. It's like it hasn't snowed in 2 weeks and somebody's up there on 120 millimeter underwaist skis. I'm like, what are you doing? Like you can't
Yeah.
ski now on those skis. So one thing I'm seeing is straight lining and it drives me crazy. It's like skiing, turning is the heart of skiing. It is what we are meant to do on snow is turn. And of course, yes, glide when and all that stuff. But turning is how we control our speed, and it's also the hardest thing to do in skiing.
And the
So I
funnest
want
thing.
to see more people putting effort into turning better. And then when I do see people putting effort in, typically, man, there's so many different directions I could go. Timing is one thing.
Yeah.
Timing's a big thing. People like dive in too fast. I would say timing, trust, projecting, really. So, I would say there's certain levels. There's the people that aren't quite carving yet that just need to trust themselves more. They're just
Cool.
not
Yeah, so
trusting that they're going to put the ski on edge and it's going to bite and then they can push through the turn. And then the next level up, I see people who are look really good and I'm sure they feel good because they are carving, but not the whole turn. And that's because they're trusting how to carve. They're trusting their skis. they understand what the feeling is, but they're not putting it all together, especially moving through the turn. And so they might just get a big angle and then switch the angle, as opposed to like dancing. You know, you're moving through the snow. And, tell one of, the most successful U.S. men's coaches in history, Phil McNichol, who's a good friend of mine and was inducted into the U.S. Ski Hall of Fame because of his coaching. He would tell people, skiing is a movie. It's a motion picture. It's not a photo. So a photo, you just sit there. You're just like stuck, like in this position. And a movie is a motion picture. There's motion and there's movement to it. And that's what, and when you're carving, if you're not moving with it, you're not going to get the most out of your ski and have the cleanest turn and also look really good. So,
Yeah, because there is, I don't think that's part of it.
yeah.
I think the style part, why some people look so good and other people, like, yeah, they're carving, there's two lines, in the snow and they're tipped over, like, maybe their knuckles even dragging. The difference between that and, people talk about like working the ski, which is maybe another way of talking about like putting energy and actually moving along length and projecting. But that's the main difference. Because if you're standing there and rather than just being a passenger, like on a sitting on a roller coaster, you're actually trying to like move more with it and do more than just what this piece of wood and metal kind of does. That's the difference. And so then with those people, I think like that's where your Schlopi drill, that's why you liked that one for yourself because it really got you extending and moving more, correct?
It really got me. It did a lot for me. I exaggerated that pinch, rib cage to pelvis pinch. Which, and now I've looked at that a little bit differently. Sometimes I try and actually inclinate at the top of the turn, and then I can angulate like from the apex, and that's really the most important is basically apex in the bottom of the turn to get angulated. The top of the turn, I've been messing around with really inclinating in. And then angulating, because if you angulate too much at the top of the turn, you're too disciplined. It doesn't let your feet go out as much. So, but the Schlopi drill doesn't stop you from doing that. As long as your hands on your hip and you can feel where you are with that inclination, angulation, and your hand starts here and it pushes forward, projecting down the hill, and your legs doing the same. So again, in unison, you're dancing and your arm and your leg are extending together. That's the main point of the drill.
Yeah. You know what I've found is also a good like indicator that someone, even before they've made a turn, is probably gonna try be static in carving is that they can't skate. They get off the lift and they
There you go.
walk, they just step their feet like a duck.
Yes.
And even they try and skate and they're like lifting the tip up and they can't glide.
I'm so glad you brought that up because when I work with kids, even when I was coaching the US ski team guys for like 6 months or 8 months, I would do skate drills. And I'm like, guys, if we're going to do a race, we'll do a relay race. When I have kids that are like 10, 12, 14, I mean, I would do it. It's fun. Doing a relay race, whether you're 10 or 50 or 80, doesn't matter. It's kind of fun. So I'd line the kids up, put two poles 50 meters away on something that's dead flat or close to it, maybe a slight incline. Take their poles away and then say, okay, ready, go. And then, and they're racing up. They go around the gate, come back, tag. And you can tell the good skiers are the ones who skate the fastest because they know where the power is and they can drive off that. I'm so glad you brought that up because
Yeah.
skating and I've told Spider, my son, his coaches, I said, groom the soccer field and then go play speedball or rugby on skis. So just have some rock skis, two teams. I guarantee the kids are going to get a good workout and they're going to come away better skiers.
Yeah. Because it's hard to find those drills that really, you know, take that element that it's hard to kind of articulate. Like you said, like there's a timing element, this projection, there's all these words we use. If you go and try and skate, it's like that. So see how you can't go from A to B very fast and yeah. I can get good at that. That's, and trust me, just then start feeling that in your turn. That's the difference, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you brought that up. Skating yeah. is a well, big deal with poles
yeah, I know
but,
Sasha does
and
it
without
as well.
Poles. Yeah. What was the last one?
Sasha was a big one on that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Sasha Rurik. Yeah. He's like skating. Yeah. Yeah. On the soccer field. Like, yeah. Get him out. Flat terrain. Yeah. Cool. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but Eric, great to catch up again. There's some cool little nuggets in there for people and some takeaways. If you've got a kid or you know someone young that's interested in getting some extra race training in and wants to go to New Zealand, I mean, I think even just the trip to New Zealand, if people haven't done that, it's just incredible. My favorite place to travel to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even on the down days,
and that's actually a huge part of our concept is, you know, we've trained everywhere in the world. And this time of year, summer training, New Zealand, Chile, glaciers. Chile's really good training, but you're sleeping at 10,000 feet and you never leave the hotel because you're stuck on the side of a mountain. New Zealand, you're sleeping at almost sea level. And there's grass around you and you drive up to the mountain, you train, and then you come down and then you can go play soccer, play golf. On days off, you can go to the coast and go surfing, go to
wineries.
Yeah, I mean, on and on. And so from a life adventure standpoint, because that's, you know, it's like, hey, you got to look at the big picture. We all want to be faster skiers, but you got to enjoy life too. And New Zealand is just a wonderful spot to have a ski camp because there's a nice life balance in there.
Yeah. And I don't have US dollars, but US dollars to NZ dollars right now is not too bad.
So. Okay. That's good to know. Yeah. I haven't even looked. We're just doing it.
Eric, thank you so much again.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Hey, good luck to Spider. I hope he's feeling well soon and gets back into it. I'll be interested to hear where that goes. And
yeah, well, we're actually heading to Austria. He and I are flying to Austria. We're going to ski in Hintertux or one of the glaciers for 10 days, just one-on-one, but we're going to pick two drills, try and do 10,000 turns focused on one or two drills, and that's it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Can't wait.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks
Good to see you,
Eric.
Tom. Thanks for having me. All right.